The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Over the past 72 hours, both warring parties have repeatedly accused each other of violating the tenuous truce. The latest back and forth began Friday morning when Iran announced the strait would reopen. President Trump, however, said the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports would remain in place until a deal is reached. So Iran then, in return, said it would once again enforce restrictions over the waterway. And on Saturday, it fired on two Indian-flagged ships trying to transit. President Trump described that action as a, quote, total violation of our ceasefire. Reiterated his threat to knock out, quote, every single power plant and bridge in Iran. Then, in the latest test of the truce, the president announced yesterday that the U.S. military attacked and seized an Iranian cargo ship it said was attempting to get past the American blockade of Iran's ports and coastline. Trump said a U.S. Navy-guided missile destroyer in the Gulf of Oman warned the ship to stop before, quote, blowing a hole in the engine room when it didn't listen. Tehran is now warning it will respond to and retaliate against what it calls a violation of the ceasefire and an act of piracy. So all of that means it's unclear if the talks between the U.S. and Iran are actually going to happen today.
Hundreds of commercial tankers are now stranded on both sides of the strait after Iran halted traffic in the strait over the weekend, reversing course on its decision to effectively open it on Friday, agreeing with the United States. Tehran now telling shippers they must use new traffic lanes along the Iranian coast. But President Trump told me yesterday on the phone that it was the U.S. who closed the strait because of the blockade. U.S. officials are gearing up for another round of talks in Pakistan tonight. The Iranians, however, still no response on this meeting. The state media is suggesting that Iran might not show up, although AP reported this morning that the meeting is on. And President Trump told me yesterday a deal will be signed tonight.
They wanted to close up the strait again, you know, as they've been doing for years. They can't blackmail us. And we'll be talking about Iran later. We have very good conversations going on. It's working out very well. They got a little cute, as they have been doing for 47 years. Nobody ever took them on. We took them on.
The latest back and forth, it's consuming quite a lot of the time that our news gatherers have. Just to keep pace with the back and the forth and the back and the forth. Is the war on? Is the war off? Is there a ceasefire? Is there not a ceasefire? It continues. It continues. And we'll try to make sense of it on today's show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on the program. You can get to the live video stream of this show at our website, thetrumpet.com, or at the Rumble channel, the YouTube channel, the email address. If you want to submit some feedback, it's td@thetrumpet.com. So one of our news gatherers talked about this perhaps being the worst. We've given President Trump credit. He did do something. And after 47 years, it was long overdue. And the push button warfare, it's impressive. The firepower of the United States, it's still there. I mean, we've still got the strength. But as we've often said, we're spending it in vain. Now just step back for a moment and look at the strategy, or lack thereof. Is this one of the worst strategies ever in the history of American warfare? You just go right down the list. The changing, you know, war aims. First, it's unconditional surrender. Then it's something less. Then it's total obliteration of the nuclear weapons program. J.D. Vance is over there calling for maybe a 20-year moratorium. Which is it? Back and forth. Through it all, you've got these premature declarations of victory. Yeah, we've achieved our aims. We declare victory. We've totally obliterated the enemy. The focus on, as our news gatherer put together here, focusing on narratives, not the facts, not communicating with allies. European leaders have made a big deal out of this. Now, for Trump's part, he has said, if I communicate what our aim is going to be, it's going to be leaked to the press because there's so many people that hate him. I mean, that's another subject altogether. The lack of trust between America and its so-called allies, and vice versa as well, forcing a ceasefire with no concessions, forcing a ceasefire in Lebanon against Israel's will, little Judah, fighting for a deal. We just have to make a deal. And how many times have we heard this? You make a deal or else we're going to blow up your bridges. We're going to blow up your infrastructure. I mean, here we were patting ourselves on the back Friday, just 3 days ago. We've got it. We've got the deal. The strait is open. And then you hear what it says there in the cold open. Another weekend of uncertainty. Another weekend introducing more questions, more concerns, just making these, I've got a long list of all the posts that President Trump has made on Truth Social, lots of declarations that in some cases are just random, meant to offend, meant to shock people, I guess. And again, I mean, he deserves credit for at least confronting the King of the South, the head of the snake. But this is not, I mean, this is not American warfare in its glory days. This is not the stuff of General Patton or MacArthur or Ulysses S. Grant. Certainly not. All these arbitrary timelines and objectives, changing objectives, not being... Going into this totally unprepared for a Hormuz blockade. And then just the communication or lack thereof. I mean, these are just a few of the things that you can think about just off the top of your head. Lee Smith, he has an article at Tablet talking about President Trump being pressured to accept an Obama-style deal with Iran. You mean we're coming back to Obama? Lee Smith says, Iran can't have a nuclear bomb, says Donald Trump, so it can't be allowed to enrich uranium. Not now, not ever. Accordingly, former Barack Obama aides responded favorably to news that Vice President J.D. Vance told the Iranian delegation he met with in Pakistan last weekend, that he was willing to erase his boss's red line and offer Iran a deal that allows it to enrich after 20 years. I mean, that's Obama. That's the sunset clause from the JCPOA. That's the same thing. J.D. Vance, anything to make a deal, even if it upsets President Trump. Even if it gives Iran a chance to declare victory, this is where we are. It's certainly not God's world. You're seeing, as I say, everything intersects with the Olivet prophecy. Everything is connected to what Jesus told us to prepare for, to look out for. In Matthew 24, and Luke 21, Mark 13, you add to it what Paul said and 2 Timothy 3, the dangerous times that we're living in. We noticed this article just a couple hours ago from Wall Street Journal. Germany is reinventing itself as a weapons factory. What? First of all, it's not reinventing itself. It's just reverting back to its old history. It's reverting back to its old war-making ways. I mean, that's like it's embedded in the DNA of Assyria. This is a war-making nation or a war-making people And then the headline, this headline will roll down just in another couple of hours. What's the big deal? A German war factory? A few months ago at the Atlantic, you've got the German war machine. It says here, as autos and heavy manufacturing falter, Berlin is steering factories, workers, and capital toward rearming Europe. I mean, the weapons are there. Germany's becoming one of the leading, you know, arms exports in the world. What happens when they say, you know what, enough with the exporting, we just want to keep our weapons. We're going to keep them at home. We're going to keep them in the fatherland. As its export model breaks down, Germany is pivoting from cars to cannons and trying to turn industrial decline into a defense boom. I mean, I can't believe this is in the Wall Street Journal, and it's not going to get any attention. Don't worry, it won't get any attention, except on this show. It's not going to be on the nightly talk shows this evening, the news cycle. I mean, it makes it into one article. And then it'll appear as another article in some other publication later. And then it just gets buried. Buried under the news cycle. Buried under the narratives. Buried under, is it a ceasefire or not? Do we have an open strait or not? What about this tweet? We just saw a provocative tweet. After decades as Europe's manufacturing engine, the country is mired in its longest stretch of stagnation since World War II, as it wrestles with competition from China and a slump in demand. The response is as stark as the crisis, recasting its industrial base as the West's arsenal. The arsenal of the West. Is this a safe world we're reading about here? Is this what leads to safety and prosperity and peace and unity? When Germany is arming the world for war? It says a mesh of data points reveal how the old model has cracked. Each month, roughly 15,000 jobs are disappearing from German manufacturing, including the once dominant auto sector, according to government figures. Mercedes-Benz posted a 49% drop in profit in 2025, while Volkswagen, the world's second largest car maker, said its profit dropped 44% in the same period and announced plans to cut 50,000 jobs in Germany by 2030. It's the same. Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, it goes on to talk about Porsche. It says now as American security guarantees look less certain and Europe races to rearm, Berlin is positioning itself to become the backbone of the continent's defense industry. That's another astounding article. The backbone of European defense. There's this clip from, I think it's President Trump talking about, if you guys can find it, it's the one where he talked about how NATO didn't come to our aid. I mean, we went through some of this last week. But they didn't support America. So America's learned a great lesson, right? America is saying, led by President Trump, we've got to go it alone. And then you've got European leaders for their part saying, can't trust America. We've got to go it alone. And then Germany spearheading the construction of this war machine. If you guys have that clip, go ahead and play it. Otherwise, I'll keep quoting from this article.
And now that the Hormuz Strait situation is almost over, I received a call from NATO asking if we would like some help. Thank you very much, NATO. And I told them I would have liked your help 2 months ago, but now I really don't want your help anymore. Because they were absolutely useless when we needed them. But actually, we never needed them. They needed us. We spend money. We spend, I would say, in many cases, close to $1 trillion over a couple of years, $1 trillion to help them. And we're always helping them. And if NATO teaches us any one thing, and I hope you all watched, because they weren't there for us, if it teaches us any one thing, we have to rely on ourselves. We can't rely on outside countries and outside sources.
Some truly earth-shaking statements from both sides of the Atlantic. America goes it alone. A German-led Europe going it alone. This article, a great trend in the German economy is that people are asking much more than before, how can we contribute to what has not been done over the last many years to regain the ability to defend ourselves? How can we support this effort to rebuild a German war machine? Again, this is not Germany reinventing itself. This is Germany reverting back to what Churchill and Roosevelt and all the others coming out of World War II said would never, never, never happen again. It cannot happen again. Germany cannot be militarized again. It can never happen. That's what Western leaders, that's what Israelite leaders were saying just 75, 80 years ago. Not so today. Instead, you heard what he said there. And the crowds just, oh, they're so excited to see Germany go it alone with its new war machine. They're clapping, they're laughing, they're cheering. It's the 1930s all over again. But this time, I mean, it's just so obvious. I guess at one point it was pretty obvious in the late 1930s when Germany was actually on the march, when Germany was actually on the offensive. Now, you see, it gets camouflaged by this, well, we've just got to be able to defend. It's all about defense, you see. We can't trust Orange Hitler. Putin is a menace. Let's talk about him, because we need to put as many excuses out there as we can. Now you've got the economy. I mean, we've got all these manufacturers laying off employees. We've got to build weapons. We've got to stop making cars, and we've got to stop building cannon. Start building cannons, I should say. Missiles, drones, AI technology. On and on it goes. Rosenfeld's firm, it says here, is now making engines for drones, onboard systems for armored vehicles, and components for military aviation. The government's on board. Berlin's approach isn't to revive the old economy, but to replace it. This is chilling stuff. Idle factory floors and a growing pool of laid-off skilled workers are being redirected into the only sector still expanding at scale. It's the only sector expanding. Even as every other sector is being, you know, reduced, or there's cutbacks, slash and burn. But with the defense industry, well, now that's altogether different. A swath of companies have added third shifts to churn out weapons and ammunition for Ukraine. Third shifts. I think if I understand what that means, you know, you've got the first 8-hour shift, then you've got the second 8-hour shift. That would be into the deep of night. And then you've got the overnight shift. In other words, 24/7 churning out weapons so that they can defend themselves. Nearly 90% of European venture capital invested in defense technology is flowing into German companies, according to government figures. Pretty amazing. What does your Bible say about the last days? Jesus compared it to the days before the flood. He said it's going to be just like the days of Noah. He said it's going to be just like the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. Later this week, we're going to talk about this public Bible reading that's going on in Washington, D.C. this week. all these celebrities and sports stars and politicians that are sold on the fact that we're living through a religious resurgence. And so they're, initially I thought, well, they'll read just a few excerpts here and there, like you typically hear in a 15-minute message. After all the rock bands and everything else, the entertainment, the concert's over on Sunday morning, then you get right down to the actual message, and it's, you know, maybe 15 minutes, maybe based on one scripture, one verse taken out of context. I thought that's the way that this Bible reading would go, as it is. I mean, they're going to get a collection of people reading the Bible right through this week, the entire Bible. Which made me think, what are they going to, I don't know who's reading what. I know President Trump's reading 2 Chronicles 7. We'll talk more about this on Wednesday. I think he reads it tomorrow night. You know, the verse that we've drawn so much attention to, verse 14. If my people will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways. And look at how many preachers and commentators have deleted that little phrase right out of the verse. I hope President Trump reads it. I hope he reads the entire verse and thinks about what God inspired there. And then I get to thinking, well, who's reading Genesis 19 about Sodom and Gomorrah? Who's reading what Isaiah and Ezekiel said about Sodom and Gomorrah? And then you add to that Jude in the New Testament or Peter in his epistles, likening our time, our day to Sodom and Gomorrah, Jesus himself. I would think the ones that are going to read the Gospels are going to be in for some eye-opening verses that maybe they've never really understood or read even before. We'll see. We'll see. It'll be great to have it on tape. So someone sent me a clip of Russell Brand sitting down with Tucker Carlson. And Russell Brand read the second half of Daniel 11, which culminates in the King of the North going against the King of the South like a whirlwind. And I think Tucker's response was, well, these are like headlines. Yes, they are. They actually are. They're prophecies being fulfilled. And then you get into the rest of the interview, and it's just, you know, it's like you would expect in this world, just all over the map. God sure has given us special insight and understanding of His truth, His Word. And I mean, God says, study it. Study it to show yourself to be a good workman before God. That's in 2 Timothy 2:15. I mean, we study to please God. If you're reading the Bible an hour a day, well, I mean, that counts for something. It's unusual. But added to that, I mean, you've got to have the attitude of a little child. Matthew 11:25, you've got to be childlike, teachable, and you've got to accept correction. This morning in class, we went through John 14 and 15, the final Passover ceremony that Jesus gave to his disciples. And in John 15 there, it talks about, you know, being a vine, or rather the branch attached to the vine that is Jesus Christ, and how that God the Father is the husbandman or the farmer, and he's periodically pruning us back so that we'll produce more fruit. A type of correction. And as I was telling our students, that's why you have to embrace correction. Receive it. You know, Judas, he had opportunities to get right with God. He was greedy. He was plotting Jesus's murder. He was self-centered, self-absorbed. And Christ corrected him, but he wouldn't receive it. He wouldn't turn from his wicked ways. And he went off and, well, after he turned in Jesus Christ, after he betrayed Christ, for 30 pieces of silver, he went off and committed suicide, not receiving correction, not turning to God, turning away from your wickedness and repenting before God. It just leads to misery, suffering, death. And that's what we see in the world today. It's everywhere. And it's exactly the way Jesus said it would be in these last days. Genesis 6, verse 11. Before the flood, it says, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. This is what we've done. We've corrupted God's way. God's way has been virtually blotted out of this earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. You had this horrific shooting in Louisiana. More evidence of demonic activity and influence. It's all, let me just read to you John 14. As I say, we read this in class today. This is Christ giving his final instructions, his final Passover message to the disciples, God's students, God's people. And he says here at the end of John 14, verse 29, and now I have told you before it comes to pass that when it is come to pass, you might believe. I'm giving you all of this ahead of time. I'm letting you know where this is leading. He was to be crucified the next day, and he had to keep reminding the disciples that this was going to happen. And he says, before this, he says, I'm giving you a new commandment, that you love one another the way I loved you. He's talking about sacrificial love for others. Being willing to lay down your life for your friends, as he says earlier in this chapter. There's no greater love than that. And then he says in verse 30, hereafter I will not talk much with you, for the prince of this world comes and has nothing in me. The prince of this world, he's coming after you. That's speaking of Satan the devil, your adversary. He's going to come after you. You've got a massive target on your back. Satan's going to try to destroy you. Satan and his demon army. It's like my father says in America Under Attack. I mean, look at all of the demons that Jesus encountered during his ministry, that the apostles encountered there in Acts 8 with the exchange in Simon Magus and Samaria. Look at all the demonic activity that Paul encountered. He wrote about it in 2 Corinthians 11, Galatians 1. And where are those demons today? Well, you can't see them. They're invisible. But you can certainly see what they're doing, what they're inspiring, what they're behind. The shooting in Louisiana, 7 kids. This father just went through the house and shot them all in the head. The New York Post says the deranged Army vet dad who gunned down his 7 children and their cousin confessed he was drowning in dark thoughts and told his stepdad that some people don't come back from their demons just weeks before the heinous killings, according to a report. You just don't come back from your demons, he said. He admitted, I've got some demons that I'm wrestling with. Shamar Elkins, 31, killed 8 children, 5 girls and 3 boys, ages 3 to 11, and seriously wounded 2 women, believed to be his wife and girlfriend, when he went on a shooting rampage through Shreveport following an argument with his spouse around 6 a.m. Sunday. I mean, it's gotten some publicity, but, you know, the people involved are black, so it doesn't get the publicity that it should. But just a horrific, horrific mass murder. And demons are behind it. The earth is filled with violence. I mean, this is the kind of story that should be getting headlines all over the world, and that should shock people into taking some kind of righteous action. How do we eliminate this? How do we stop this? How do we overcome this? It says here, just weeks ago on Easter Sunday, Elkins called his mother and his stepfather and chillingly told them he was drowning in dark thoughts, wanted to end his life, and that his wife wanted a divorce. So more family dysfunction, more demonic activity, more violence. I told him, you can beat stuff, man. I don't care what you're going through. You can beat it. Then I remember him telling me, some people don't come back from their demons. Elkins said she was unclear, I think this is the mother, what problems her son and his wife, who were married in 2024 and had four kids together, were dealing with. But a relative of one of the wounded women said the couple was in the middle of a separation proceedings and was due in court on Monday. Listen, I think I had a clip on this one. What was it? I think it was number 8, if you wanted to play 8.
Now to the horrifying news from Shreveport, Louisiana, where a man killed 7 of his own children and another child on Sunday. The oldest of the children was 11 years old, the youngest, just 3.
This was the nation's deadliest shooting in more than 2 years. Police said that the gunman shot 10 people, killed those 8 children here in the house directly behind me, then stole a car at gunpoint and led police on a chase, all of this early Sunday morning.
Police say Shamar Elkins killed 8 children, including 7 of his own, in an execution-style shooting in Shreveport, Louisiana, early Sunday morning.
When he returned here, he began to execute children.
The incident started as a domestic dispute around 5 in the morning. According to police, Elkins shot a woman in the face at one house, then went to the house where his children were and shot another woman. Police say he pursued the children, even as some of them tried to escape.
Were they crawling out of windows to get onto a roof?
Yes. So actually, this house right here that you see behind us, there's a window right above the garage. They actually climbed out of that window, we believe. And unfortunately, one of the children was actually located deceased on the roof. So we are working to determine. We do believe that he shot the child while the child was on the roof trying to get away.
Police said the shooter then stole a vehicle from a driver at gunpoint and led officers on a multi-parish chase. When he stopped in a neighborhood and got out with a gun, officers shot and killed him. Photos posted to the gunman's Facebook page show him with several children, one posted just 2 weeks ago, captioned, "With all my kids, what a blessed day."
But I suppose just like the Wall Street Journal piece about Germany reinventing itself, that'll get buried under the news cycle in a matter of hours, and we'll just move on. This New York Post piece says the victims killed by Elkins have been identified. Well, it lists all the names. Again, 3 to 11, the ages. 7 of the 8 were his own children, and the 8th was their cousin. They were all found dead inside their home in Shreveport. Most of the victims were shot in the head while they slept. Most of them shot in the head. That was in Shreveport, July 9th, by the way. That's when Celtic Throne will perform in Shreveport this summer. This world is dying. This world needs hope. This world needs God's truth. It needs the commandments. It needs what Jesus was talking about at his final Passover. It needs a foot washing attitude. It needs the new commandment. It needs the love of God. It needs to love one another as Jesus loved us. Well, that is coming. I mean, God's giving us the vision through Celtic Throne and through this program, through the Key of David, through the Trumpet magazine, all the literature. I think about John's gospel, the love of God, that wonderful message in that wonderful book. You think about this sacrificial love. Jesus Christ talked about love the night before he was crucified, and he said, look, you're going to have to sacrifice for others. You're going to have to lay down your life for your friends, for God's family. And then he went out the next morning and he did it. He showed them. And while he was going through that horror, all of his disciples were abandoning him, just as he said that they would. At the end, God had to turn away because he became that sin sacrifice. Jesus Christ stood alone, but he was faithful to the end, and he claimed the greatest victory in the history of mankind, in the history of the universe. You wonder what some of these Bible readers are going to think when they get to maybe, what, the Olivet Prophecy? Or 2 Timothy 3? Or what Peter said in his second epistle? Or the book of Revelation? How about that one? Or what about what Paul said about homosexuality in Romans 1? Romans 1, New Testament. Well, what about what Paul said regarding the family of God? God being a family, heading up a household, how that he's a father, how that we're his children, how that the church is to marry Christ. You don't hear this in Christian denominations, and yet it's all through the Bible. I hope that the Bible reading will open some eyes. If not in other people, at least the ones reading it. Well, as we know from John 6:44, it takes a miracle. It takes a miracle to understand this book. And that's why we should be ever thankful and grateful when God does, in fact, perform the miracle and open our minds. There's a psalm. I read it over the weekend. Psalm 119 just comes to mind. As I was telling the students this morning, I mean, just working to be more appreciative of the truth that God's given to us and the fact that we can look into these scriptures and understand and know the meaning and appreciate the truth. Psalm 119, this is the prophet Jeremiah, and he says here in verse 62, at midnight I will rise to give thanks unto you because of your righteous judgments. And I forget, I think it's Psalm 39 maybe, where David said the same thing. He talked about the three watches of night and how that, you know, when he, you know, we encourage our students here on campus to go to bed and to sleep through the night because a lot of evil happens at night. You can protect yourself from a lot of evil if you just go to bed at a decent hour and then rise early and set your mind in the direction of God. But there are occasions, rare occasions. Jesus demonstrated this at Gethsemane and when he was selecting his disciples, where he was up all through the night. But what was he doing? He wasn't off, you know, vandalizing a shop or terrorizing individuals. He was drawing near to God at midnight, it says here. The prophet, he got up and he praised God. He gave thanks to God. He set his mind on the things of God. I mean, that's a real test of character, godly character. What it is we do when we're all alone, late at night or early in the morning. God sees it. I mean, God knows. At midnight, I will rise to give thanks unto you because of your righteous judgments. If I wake up, I'm going to get up and praise you because of your judgments, because of your truth, because of your commandments. Read Psalm 119 and see how often Jeremiah refers to the commandments of God, the statutes of God, the truth of God, the laws of God. It's all through the psalm. He loved it. He meditated on it. So did David. That's why David had a heart like God's. And so did Jesus Christ. Here we have such wonderful examples of how we ought to behave as true Christians. Love one another as I have loved you. This world is, it belongs to the prince of this world. And Jesus said so in the final Passover, and Paul, of course, said it in 2 Corinthians 4. You see it in Revelation 12. Again, what are these Bible readers going to think when they get to 2 Corinthians 4:4? Or Revelation 12:9, the whole world is deceived. I'm kind of looking forward to hearing that one on tape. Whoever it is that has Revelation 12. Lots and lots of Bible reading. And a world that's just going the way of the devil. Just as Jesus prophesied. Just like the days of Noah. And then you go back to Genesis 6 and you see what the world that then was really like. It wasn't a good place. The end of all flesh was near. And, you know, for a century, they made fun of Noah. They mocked him. They ridiculed him. They said, what are you building this giant ark for? I mean, come on. They continued on with their partying. They were having a good old time until the rains intensified. Yesterday, this was Joe Rogan and a few others as they were trying to encourage President Trump to open the way for access to more psychedelic drugs, as if that's what we need to solve the problems of all this demonic activity in the world today. We just need more drugs. We need more mind-altering drugs. This is clip 9.
Today I'm pleased to announce historic reforms to dramatically accelerate access to new medical research and treatments based on psychedelic drugs. In many cases, these experimental treatments have shown life-changing potential for those suffering from severe mental illness and depression, including our cherished veterans. And I got a call from a number of people, including the great Joe Rogan, and he said, we have to do something about this. And I looked into it. I called Bobby, I called Oz, I called Marty and Jay, and it was uniform support. And I said, so why would we wait 3 or 4 years to get it done? Or 10 years, frankly. Let's get it done immediately. And that's what happened. This has probably never been anything happened so quickly. Everybody is so strongly in favor of this. It's for a lot of people, but it's for our military in particular. The suicide epidemic among veterans is a national tragedy. Since 9/11, we've lost over 21 times more veteran lives to suicide than on the battlefield. And today we're bringing them new hope. I think you're going to see a big difference and a big reduction in that number.
It makes me think of all of the praise that the experts had for the COVID vaccine. If you're like me, you've probably seen a lot of clips online, nurses and others, studies and so on, that are confirming what we were saying, what we on this program were saying 5-6 years ago, that the vaccine is going to kill people. It's going to hurt people. The cure is worse than the disease. And here we come with all these big statements again. Yeah, now we've got more drugs, just so that you know. There's a problem with suicide, depression, PTSD, all these things. And those are real. I mean, mental illness is real. But we're not asking the right questions, are we? Instead, we're just trying the same old things with a little bit of added technology. More drugs. Here, this is being announced right after you have this horrific killing in Louisiana. Father who admitted, I am wrestling with demons. And he goes to the house and he just kills one child after the next, after execution style. Shoots them in the head while they're asleep in their beds. 3 years old, 5 years old, 7 years old. If only he could have gotten drugs before that. This is not God's world, certainly not. And yet there is hope. The hope is in the Olivet prophecy. The hope is in the return of Christ. The hope is in God's family government. The hope is in Jesus Christ as King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and the Bride of Christ. You can look at that Olivet prophecy. Let's just look at it here before we conclude. Matthew 24. Matthew 24, it says, verse 37, but as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. The coming of Christ. Now, in the final Passover, John 14, you can read it in John 14, 2. He said to his disciples the day before he's crucified, if I go, I'm coming back. I'm coming again. And by the way, where I'm going, I'm going to prepare offices for you. You're going to abide with the Father and me for all eternity. Here he says, as the days of Noah, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. So the days of Noah, the days before the flood, are linked to the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. So when you see it like the days of Noah, just know it's near. It's drawing close. It's at the door. He talks about great tribulation, verses 29. Immediately after the tribulation, well, verses 21 and 22 speaks of it in some detail. And then he says in verse 29, immediately after the tribulation, of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. This is the Olivet prophecy. I can't wait till we get to this in the Bible reading week. I mean, this is spectacular. Heavenly signs as well. Great tribulation, it engulfs the earth. Okay, Jesus said that. This would be a sign of the end of the world, Matthew 24, verse 3. But that's not the end of the story. Immediately after, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, as I covered last week, why should the nations mourn? Why should this be a problem? Why won't they receive Jesus Christ with open arms? Why won't they say, finally, finally, it's here. Thank you, God, for saving us, for sparing us. They don't say that, do they? No, the nations, Revelation 11, 15, the nations were angry. God's return to this earth is going to make the nations angry. It's going to upset people. It's going to make them fight. It's going to make them turn to violence. Well, they will have been turning to violence in the years leading up to this. But this will lead to the final battle of all battles. The armies gathering in Armageddon. to fight against Jesus Christ when he returns to the Mount of Olives, the Mount of Olives, the very same place the disciples came to him at the start of this verse. Verse 3 says, this chapter, I mean, verse 3 says, and as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, he was telling them about what it was going to be like when he would return to the Mount of Olives. Notice Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14 and verse, let's just start in verse 1. I think we have enough time. It says, behold, the day of the Lord comes, and your spoil shall be divided in the midst of you, and I'll gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. This is the battle at Christ's return. And the city shall be taken, and the houses, this is speaking of Jerusalem, the houses rifled and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity. This is before even the Great Tribulation. Half the city of Jerusalem being taken. I mean, it's giving us, in kind of a backwards order, but it's giving us step by step what's going to happen in the lead up to what's mentioned in verse 4. Then shall the Lord go forth, verse 3, and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north and half toward the south. I mean, the Mount of Olives is going to split in two. This is Old Testament. Now, obviously, it's not talking about Jesus' first coming. I mean, when Jesus first came, he entered into Jerusalem there at the last on a mule. And look at what they did to him then. Even when he returns as the glorified, resurrected, all-powerful, living, all-powerful, ever-living Jesus Christ, they're going to fight against him then as well. And we're going to see these spectacular heavenly signs and the Mount of Olives splitting in two. And you can go on and read the rest of this passage. But I'll give you the conclusion of the matter. Verse 9 says, and the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one. Same as Revelation 11 and verse 15. Jesus Christ is going to be king over all the earth. Same as Revelation 19. I wonder what some of these Bible readers are going to think when they get through Zechariah 14, when they get through Revelation 19, when they go through Revelation 11, when they read 2 Thessalonians or 1 Thessalonians 4 about the return of Christ and the dead in Christ rising first to meet Jesus in the air, and those of us that remain, the faithful, the disciples, the true Christians, rising in the air, first resurrection, resurrected to spirit life. All of these truths that you just don't hear in the traditional Christian world today. Such wonderful truth, inspiring truth, a hope-filled vision there in the Olivet Prophecy, and really all throughout the Bible. That's all we have time for on today's show, the fastest moving hour in broadcasting. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.